Taking a look at what's going on in the out-of-doors these days, Larry Mueller here, my guest Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Great to have him along, and thank you very much for listening in today. As we visit with Scott, I hope you have some questions about wildlife in your area of the state or maybe somewhere else. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234 or email at Scott. talk@wpr.org. Scott, welcome back.
Well, nice to be here as always, Larry.
We've got a pretty warm and wet conditions across a good share of Wisconsin. That's good for crops.
Well, it's good for some things. It's not very good for me. I'm really tired of this
frogs
heat
are doing
and humidity,
well.
And now the mosquito crop. My gosh! But it has been very good. I think the frogs have been fooled. The neighbor's pond is just, well, it filled up with the big rains about a week and a half ago, and the chorus frogs showed back up in the pond as if it were April, and they're singing like crazy the last few nights. I think they're trying to sneak in a second breeding season.
Well, I tell you what, we have lots of callers online, but before we go a little further, I wanted to mention Kemp, Natural Resources Station, because that's a real gem that we have here in the state, and I'm not sure everybody knows about it. In fact, I'm pretty sure of that.
It is a gem. It's an outpost of UW-Madison in the Northwoods, and there aren't many of them. It's one of 12 research stations administered by the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. Kemp was or has a long history dating back to acquisition of the land by the Kemp family back in the late 1800s. But the property itself, as it's currently configured, was donated to the university by Susan Small and Sally Greenleaf, great-grandchildren of Edward Kemp, in 1960. So the university got, I think it was about 105 acres of land, thousands of shore feet on Lake Tomahawk,
yeah,
which
beautiful.
Is a gem in the Northwoods. And the buildings in particular are particularly noteworthy. These are 1920s vintage log structures, just gorgeous. And since 1960, it has been operated as a research station devoted entirely to natural resources, and it's the only one of the ag research stations with that particular mission. Most are devoted to certain crops, the Peninsula Station, fruit crops, livestock, things like that. But Kemp deals with both research, outreach, and education, all with a natural resources flair. So there are many things that go on there in the course of an average year, with researchers coming and going, working on all manner of projects across the Northwoods. There are summer field courses for our own wildlife program and for the forestry program, many other classes visiting, weekly outreach programs for the public. A lot goes on there. It's really a great spot. And the key thing and the reason we're talking about it now is that on Saturday the 21st of August, just coming up 2 weeks from Saturday, 3 weeks, 2 weeks from Saturday,
2 weeks,
is the 50th anniversary of that 1960 donation. And there are public events scheduled for Saturday the 21st from about 10 to 3, kind of an open house and all sorts of activities, bird walks and boat tours and research talks and all sorts of things, as well as a luncheon. However, if folks are still interested in attending that or dropping by, they do need to register either by going to the Kemp website, I guess, or by calling Kemp if these are folks in the Lakeland area. And I know we do have lots of listeners up there based on the calls that we have gotten over the years. So if folks would like to stop by and see Kemp perhaps for the first time or hear what's going on or just enjoy the day, they need to either call or register online. And I think that luncheon on Saturday, I believe it's a $10 fee, and they need to know in advance by Friday the 13th if folks are interested in that. And I should point out that they feel their capacity is 130 folks, and they're already up to 105 or so registered.
No, so if, do it soon.
If anybody's interested, you know, this is sort of like, we've only got three left, buy now. but this is on the level. They really are reaching capacity, and if folks are interested, they should act quickly.
Act quickly. And how do they do that again?
Let me check here. I think that the key thing is to download a registration form.
Okay.
From the Kemp website, which is just kemp.wisc.edu. Download a registration form and take care of it that way. I suspect they could also call the Kemp number if they're local up there and talk to the folks and go ahead that way.
There you go. Sally in Wayland, Minnesota has a comment or question. Let's go there. Hi, Sally.
Hello, Larry. Thank you to you and to Jim. And hello, Scott.
Hi.
I live on the Root River next to the Bluffs, and the timber rattlers are definitely on the move. So apparently the snakes are breeding, and my questions are, how long is the gestation period? Will they be live birth or eggs? Is it true or urban legend that the baby snakes are more dangerous, and why? And lastly, how much time do I have before I'm handing out cigars?
Well, there. Let's see. I scribbled down as many of those questions as I could, Sally. First of all, timber rattlers are out and about, but typically the young are born earlier in the year, and they are born alive. So there's a kind of a fine line. You think, well, snakes give birth to live snakes, which is true. Many of our species do. However, they're actually hatched internally from retained eggs, and then the young are born, but not born in the sense that placental mammals like humans and cows and dogs and cats are. So in any event, the young snakes emerge, and with rattlesnakes, a neonate or newborn, maybe 10 or 11 inches long, they're pretty good size, and they're fully functional, as you pointed out, fairly quickly after birth. However, I don't think there's much to the fact that they're more dangerous in the sense of perhaps either more toxic venom, more venom, or anything like that. But I can imagine perhaps the smaller individual either being undetected and, you know, somebody puts their hand down next to it or sits next to it, or a child picks, oh, look at the little snake, whereas they might be more cognizant of a 4 or 5 foot adult and stay away from it. A small snake is something that could be picked up and handled. It's not much bigger than a big nightcrawler. So there might be a little more risk along those lines, but that's the only thing that I can think of.
Okay.
And this is a case of the females basically being out early in the spring and staying around the dens, basking and keeping those eggs going so that the young are born shortly thereafter.
So why are they so active right now?
After they do leave the den sites, I mean, they're out moving around the countryside during the summer months, usually around they start out around the rock formations and bluffs and so forth, where they spend the winter in hibernacula, as you're well aware. And then as they emerge from those, spring and into early summer, they start moving down and start turning up in people's driveways or agricultural fields or where people tend to come in contact with them a little more. And then eventually, as summer wanes and it gets back to fall, they move back toward the hibernacula. If you're, in terms of your local experience, just seemingly seeing a lot more activity right now, I'm inclined to think that it's got more to do with the kinds of awfully warm temperatures we've been having, or something else to do with weather conditions, more so than any phenomenon in terms of more snakes or anything like that.
Okay.
Okay?
There you go, Sally. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Fritz in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Fritz.
Hi. Good show. I enjoy it.
Thank you.
My question is, I live near Lake Winnebago in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and I was wondering, we have quite an influx of pelicans. 10 years ago, we didn't have any, and now they're in the thousands on Lake Winnebago.
Mm-hmm.
And I also spoke to a friend of mine in Hayward this morning, and he's noticed quite a change in the weather over the winter. He says a few of the lakes freeze up there anymore, and of course, Lake Winnebago barely freezes over. You know, we get some ice fishing in and some sturgeon fishing, but it's undoubtedly, I think, the weather has changed. And with these pelicans, is that a result of global warming that we're seeing, or what's your thoughts on that?
Well, two issues there, Fritz. The global climate change issue, or global warming, if you prefer, is becoming increasingly difficult to refute. I mean, the evidence is just overwhelming at this point, and I was looking at a publication in anticipation of a meeting the other day that had projections for Wisconsin through 2050 and then beyond, and with kind of worst-case scenarios and best-case scenarios. And holy cow, the worst-case scenarios, I guess I'm glad I'm not likely to be around. If those things come true and there's actually the kind of temperature increase for Wisconsin that's possible, and the increase in the number of 90-plus days and whatnot, it's going to be an uncomfortable place to be, and I don't know what the southern part of the country is going to be like. No. Unbearable. But in any event, Pelicans have been on the upswing in Wisconsin for a number of years now, not necessarily related to climate change, but they've been doing very well. I think the first major colony that got going was in Lower Green Bay. On, I think it was Cat Island, and that population quickly grew into the hundreds of pairs of birds, and they've begun to spread out into the larger lake and river systems, and have become a fairly common sight in places like Winnebago. And that's a case of the birds finding a suitable nesting habitat and a suitable food source, and the population is just growing dramatically. There's also a possibility there were some huge pelican colonies in the Dakotas, oh, 5, 6, 8, 10 years ago, that simply broke up for reasons that were poorly understood, or at least I never heard the explanations. But those thousands of breeding birds just abandoned those sites, and it's possible that we've been the beneficiary of some changes in pelican distribution across the upper Midwest and Plain states, as well as the fact that our resident pelicans, wherever they came from, are doing very well.
Yeah, there you have it. Thank you very much for calling. Jeff in Superior. You are next, Hi.
Okay, good morning.
Morning.
Many of us who enjoy outdoor recreation, like in the lower Eau Claire Lakes chain here in northern Wisconsin, have experienced like a swimmer's itch. Can we attribute it to what we call duck lice up here?
Swimmer's itch, ducks are involved as an intermediate host, as I think are snails, and it has a complicated life cycle, but basically the larvae actually burrow into your skin, and you get this mosquito bite-like welt, and there's actually the little larvae of the parasite that's burrowed into your skin. So it's a circumstance where you tend to see it in certain shallow or warmer areas of a given lake, some lakes far more than others, some lakes almost not at all. But I'm not that familiar with the life cycle to tell you the details, but it is a larval form or worm-like form of a parasite that burrows into your skin.
And is this an annual thing or one time, one year?
I think some lakes are kind of plagued by it and have a reputation for swimmer's itch, whereas it even in lakes where it's bad, there are good and bad years. Even on the Minocqua chain that we were talking about a moment ago with regard to Kemp Station, Lake Tomahawk is a deep, clear, cool lake, and I just stay in various places on the lake over the years, and there are some spots on the lake where never, ever see it, and then you go around a point into a shallower bay or where the water is a little more a little calmer or a little less flow to it or movement, and all of a sudden, boom, you know, there it is. So it can vary within a given body of water.
Yep. Very good. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Mike in Castle Rock. Hello.
Good morning. Since we live in the Badger State, I'd like to know where all the badgers are, and I'd like to see one before I croak.
Well, let's see. If you come to the Henry Vilas Zoo in Madison, you will see one. I actually, Scott, I know you're going to say they're nocturnal, but I had someone send a note onto my Facebook page that a gal said that she and her husband had observed a badger kind of in their back lawn, mm-hmm. digging around and in broad daylight. But that's a rare event, isn't it?
Well, it's a rare event to see one simply because, well, yes, they're more or less nocturnal, but people have sent us from previous callers. We said, they say, well, I have a den on a hillside on my farm, and I see the badger poke his head out of the den, and they've sent some fantastic pictures over the last few years because it's been easier to do. But badgers are distributed across the state. You could find one in any county. They're seem to be a bit more common in the north, actually, particularly in barrens and open habitats in the north and northwestern part of the state. However, I've been in the state, 40 years now, and I travel around a lot, and I know what I'm looking for, and I'm outside a lot. I have yet to see a live one. I don't mean to discourage you, Mike, before you croak, as you put it, but your best bet is going to be to keep your ears to the ground and find someone who is seeing one on a farm or in a given area, and then make an effort to get out and see it as opposed to a chance encounter. Now, while I've not seen a live one, I've seen half a dozen or more dead on the road that have been hit, And people are, I won't say constantly, but it's not. It's a fairly common event for someone to call me at the office and say, oh, I found a really nice badger on the road. Do you want it? Thinking the university with our mascot and all can use it. And we actually have taken in some very nice specimens and ultimately mounted them or had them mounted for the athletic department and so forth. So they're out there, Mike, but they're not in high densities. They're reasonably secretive. So your best bet is either good fortune or, you know, talking to people in the area and saying, hey, if you hear about a badger around or whatnot, create a little network. And if you get the call, go have a look.
There you go. Thanks, Mike. Thank you very much for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we'll take some more calls as we visit with Scott Craven. Janet in Boulder Junction. Hi, Janet.
Good morning. I've been listening to you talking about badgers, and I saw one last week, and we're up in a heavily wooded area, lots of lakes, and I was driving and saw this thing cross the road ahead of me, and as I got closer, I saw black and white, and I'm thinking skunk, until I got up close to it and saw it was very broad and flat and had the gray tail. I thought, that's a badger. And I was very surprised because, as somebody else said, I've never seen one before. So I was just kind of curious. I was going to ask about, you know, the habitat and how, you know, how frequently people see them, but I guess you've already answered that.
Well, I just point out that the habitat is reasonably variable. I mean, you've got them in a wooded area. They're reasonably common in mixed farm country and, as I said, in some of the barrens and open woodlands. Found more in the northwestern part of the state. So they're reasonably versatile in terms of their habitat selection. But once you see one, the nice thing about a badger is, boy, that black and white face is pretty hard to mistake for something else.
Oh, yes, definitely. And it was very exciting. But yeah, it was during the day, and it was just walking across the road, and then it was walking right alongside. And, of course, then I wound up going ahead of it. But it was exciting.
Thanks, Janet.
Good,
okay.
Thanks.
Appreciate the call. And, I bet she didn't get a picture. If somebody got a picture of a badger roaming around or a bear roaming around or some of these some wildlife pictures would be kind of fun. We have some up on my Facebook page, but if you've got some, you can send them to my Facebook page. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show and send those pictures. I'd love to see them. And if you haven't joined up on our Facebook page, I hope you'll do that too. We give you updates and all kinds of good things there on The Larry Mueller Show. I also have another Facebook page, Larry Mueller, but The Larry Mueller Show is the one for the radio station.
I'm going to have to visit your Facebook page, I guess, Larry.
You are. I wrote about you this morning.
Oh, good.
Let's go to Peg in Rice Lake. Hi, Peg.
Hi there. As usual, I have questions on bears.
Okay.
I'm learning to live with bears. It's really very common with me now. I had one outside my window until a minute ago. And I have two questions. One is an easy one, short. The other is a little more complex, so I hope you won't leave me high and dry on that second one. First, do bears smile like a dog?
Okay.
Smile like a dog.
Yeah. When they put their tongue out over their bottom teeth a little bit and just look at you sweetly?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer, Peg. Whether it's when you start to anthropomorphize, you know, human behaviors like smiling or frowning or whatever on any animal, it becomes a little bit dicey, and I think you can construe. I know with my own two dogs, they're both Labradors, and if you're scratching them just right, the facial expressions change. Oh, look how happy the dog is, or it's grinning, or whatever. But, you know, I'm not really so sure that that's the same cause and effect kind of thing that's in a person.
No point in lecturing me on that. I am
bears,
a full believer in anthropomorphism, whatever you call it.
I mean, bears certainly, as most wild animals, have some facial expressions, although not as much of a repertoire as primates or humans. But, you know, if you want to construe it as smiling, I guess that's not something I'm not going to argue with you about that.
Well, I'll tell you what. I had 2 years ago a mother bear here with one cub. She and I had a working arrangement whereby I could poke my head out the door and say, "Get back by the woods, Mama Bear." put baby up a tree because I got to come out. And she would. And I would walk out to my car or whatever I had to do, and then I'd go back in and say, okay, you can come out now. And she'd just, all that time, she'd just sit there and look at me. And then she'd come out again once I was in the house. Now, this year, and that cub would not, you know, it wouldn't be much of a cub anymore. It'd be getting kind of big and gone from mom, usually.
Mm-hmm.
But this year, I have a mama bear with two cubs and a young bear, probably around 3 years old. And when that young bear first showed up, and I poked my head out the door to tell it not to knock over the garbage can, which I tell them, and it just stood there. It smiled at me. I mean, the little doggy-like smile. And I thought, is this real, you know? Because, I mean, I'm not delusional, even though I might love animals very much.
Well, I think that it's just as likely that the bear's movement of its lips or nose or whatever was just as much to get a better whiff of what you were or what your intentions were as anything else. And it's also just as likely that that kind of lip or face movement was a potentially, you
grimace,
know, hey, don't mess with me kind of thing.
I can tell the difference between a stress smile or a nervous smile this kind of smile.
Did you have another question for us, by the way?
Yes, sir, a tough one. Always I've felt fairly, anyway, I'm getting pretty, you know, friendly with my mama bears because I am very careful to try not to tame them, and I have to be careful not to tame myself, too, because the more I get used to them, the more I am in danger of behaving inappropriately. So I'm very careful on both ends.
But, well, before you ask that question, Peg, I just feel compelled to point out here that you brought up a very good point, and that everyone can, with more bears in Wisconsin and bears moving south seemingly at a rapid rate, more people are going to come in contact with bears, and more people who have no bear experience will come in contact with bears. So because of that, I think it's important to emphasize that it is critically important that no one try and tame the animals. No one try and feed them. Feeding bears is illegal in Wisconsin. And that people know how to respond around a bear. They're still a big, powerful animal, and they deserve some respect, and they need to be given a wide berth. And for folks who have relatively little experience, unlike yourself, the DNR's new fact sheet called Living with Bears is a very useful,
right,
short and sweet, two-page resource that folks can download from the DNR website. And it gives you all the basics of what to do when you encounter a bear and what to do around the house when bears are around the house. So there are a lot of folks, Peg, who have a very different approach to bears than you do, and everybody needs to be a little bit mm-hmm. cautious in this. So go ahead. What's your next question?
What's your question?
I think you're going to cut me off the air for the news now. If I do, can you hang on to me
the question?
What's your question?
Mother bears. I always felt fairly safe about them because they would be up a tree and you're not supposed to shoot mother bears, right? Not supposed to shoot a bear with cubs.
Right.
I thought, well, they're safe through September. Now I have discovered that my mama bear here just once has put the babies up a tree, and then she went running down the woods path into the woods.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what occurs to me is that, okay, the cubs were so high up a tree you couldn't even see them with foliage, and that same thing will be true in September.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't even know they're there.
That's correct.
But that mama bear down the trail somewhere, she's going to get shot. Nobody's going to go 200 feet around
looking for the bear. Okay.
Well, I mean, that's certainly true, Peg. It's quite possible that a female bear that still has cubs with her, the cubs may be off doing something else. She may have left them in a tree. You know, they're back in the thick vegetation. Out comes a bear, or a bear gets treed and separated from its cubs, and it gets harvested. Certainly that could happen. But by that time in September, the cubs are at a point where they can probably take care of themselves. Perhaps not that serious a problem, but it could happen.
It could happen. So. There you have it. Thank you, Peg. Jack in Eagle River. We'll go to you now. Hi, Jack.
Yes, hi. With regularity we have a wolf howl and coyote yipping, and I always hope that we can get a command performance whenever we have guests up here, and sometimes we do. It's that regular. I was just curious, would a wolf take down a coyote? Are they natural enemies, or do they have territorial problems? And if not, would it take a pack of wolves to do that? And I have one other minor question. Do you say coyote or coyote?
Do you say potato or potato? That's up to you. I say coyote just because it's a little shorter, but coyote, I think, is probably the more
common here.
It's common, anyway. Depends a little bit on where you are. As far as wolves and coyotes, a wolf would happily and readily kill a coyote if it had the opportunity, as a coyote would kill a red fox. The members of the dog family do not get along, and they don't play well together. So where there are a lot of coyotes, foxes tend to get squeezed out of the area, and their territories are kind of in the periphery, in the spaces between coyote territories. And the same thing holds true for wolves and coyotes. So a coyote would stay out of the way of a wolf, given any opportunity to do so.
Yep, there you have it. Kathy in Clintonville, on to you now. Hi.
Good morning. We have a woodchuck. He's been around for a couple years, and we thought that maybe he left because we got rid of the wood pile, but now we know he's in a shed, and he had a wife and four children this spring, but they're gone. How do you get rid of a woodchuck?
So the woodchuck apparently chucked all the wood that you had and had to move into the shed.
Yeah, well, he moved into the shed. He's got quite a few burrows out there.
There are really three basic options if you don't want said woodchuck, and Larry has much experience in woodchuck removal. Do you see the animal occasionally?
Oh, sure. He eats on the grass out there,
And you're in the countryside?
Yes, we are.
Do you have a gun?
Well, I'd like to not do that.
Well, I mean, that's your call. However,
yeah.
If the woodchuck is fairly visible and it's in a rural area where gunfire is safe and legal, the most immediate way to deal with it is the animal is shot.
Okay.
Now, if your inclination is to try and deal with it alive so that it can live out its life elsewhere, that's a different situation. But realize that woodchucks, or groundhogs, as they're called, are a protected animal in Wisconsin, except on your own property. You are free to deal with them. Free to deal with them on your own property. So shooting is an option. The next option is fumigation of the burrow system, and you can buy gas cartridges at the co-op or hardware store or garden center that you do. It looks like a big firecracker with a fuse, and you light this thing and shove it down the burrow, and the combustion gases from the burning of the cartridge, if you've done it right and covered the holes and whatnot, will permeate the burrow, and the animal is killed by the gases. Now, you know, if you're interested in the animal's well-being, suffocation by gas combustion versus
shooting,
you'll have to think about that a little bit.
Yeah.
But the only option for removing it alive is to start using a good heavy-duty live trap, a wire live trap, baited with fresh vegetables, and see if you can catch it. Then, of course, you've got to move it. And in Wisconsin, the party line is that you must have permission from the property owner where you're going to let the animal go. So that complicates things a little bit in relocation. I realize that a lot of people move animals around the landscape, but you really should be dealing, you know, most people who have rural land or property managers like parks or even DNR areas have all the woodchucks and skunks and possums and coons they want.
Yeah.
And if you actually ask them, say, no, I don't want a problem raccoon or woodchuck on my property that I'm just going to have to deal with. So there are some complications with all the tactics, but those are your options.
I didn't know he was protected. So.
Yeah. But protected, on your property, there's a waiver of that protection so that you can deal with a problem woodchuck.
There you have it. Thank you very much for calling. Mary Lynn in Milwaukee, it is now your turn. Hi, Mary Lynn.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We were vacationing over the weekend on a lake in northern Wisconsin and took a pontoon ride around the lake and saw about 6 to 7 adult loons. And I have never seen that many loons all together. Normally you'll see pairs, and it seemed very unusual to us, and I don't know if it is unusual or not.
No, not particularly unusual, especially as you get later in the year. The loons begin to gang up in preparation for clearing out, and summer, although it certainly doesn't feel like it, is winding down. So there are a lot of birds coming up very quickly. The swallows, the blackbirds will be starting to gather up in preparation for clearing out. And loons, to a certain extent, do the same thing. But you also may be, if you're on a big lake that has a good fish resource, you can see a number of loons in the same general area just because it's a good place to be.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it may be non-breeding loons. It may be loons that lost their young, and then they start to gather up in particularly favorable spots.
So I thought maybe a bachelor group, but it wouldn't even have to be a bunch of bachelors.
Not necessarily.
Okay. All right. Great. Thank you.
Okay.
On Madison's Lake Monona, a birdwatcher counted on the lake, I think it was somewhere between 40 and 60 on that lake.
Some years there's a huge concentration of loons there.
Paul in Cascade, let's turn to you now. Hi, Paul.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Morning.
Monday, I saw five, what I'm going to call weasels, crossing the road, the mother and four young.
Mm-hmm.
They were all black, pure black. I was wondering if that's what I saw, or was it a mink?
What county's Cascade in?
Sheboygan.
Sheboygan. I'm guessing, and was there water nearby?
No.
Hard to tell. Well,
not that I could see anyway, no.
So how big was Mom?
Oh, 7, 8, 9 inches long, maybe.
Okay, including the tail, or? Well, the bottom line is a dark weasel-like animal with a long cylindrical form and out marching around, the odds are pretty good, especially in that area of mink, as you suggested. And their typical wild coloration is a really dark, rich chocolate brown, but it would appear, depending
black.
On the light or whatever, it would easily look black. So the other possibilities in the weasel family, long-tailed weasel, short-tailed weasel, smaller and much more of a golden brown, not something you'd describe as black and with a light-colored belly, whereas the mink is uniform color all the way around except for a white blaze on their throat. So that size, if you were further north, then you start to get into things like more likely otters, fishers, other members of the weasel family that are also dark-colored and might be out, but those are much larger animals.
Yeah, I was thinking they are bigger, right? Yeah.
Much bigger,
much
yes.
Much bigger.
Much bigger. So based on that size and the coloration, I'm going to go with a family of mink out for a stroll.
There you have it. Thank you very much for calling. We have an email from Eleanor who has seen adult male cardinals losing their feathers around their heads. Why might this be happening, Scott?
Well, there are a couple possibilities. For this particular case, I don't know. But in some circumstances, there are various feather mites and whatnot that cause an appearance that looks almost mangy-like if you were thinking about a mammal. That's one possibility. In other cases, if there are either a lot of cardinals or some aggression around a feeder, birds peck each other around the head. And occasionally, if the bird is weakened in some respect, it may be being pecked or picked on by other birds or even amongst themselves. And thirdly, young birds are coming online here, and there's also some molting going on, so it may just be a function of either young bird getting adult feathers or adult bird in the process of some sort of molting. So there are a number of possibilities, but other than the possibility of some sort of a mite infection or something like that, probably nothing that serious.
An email from Doug, who's listening in Indiana, and he asks, what's the normal diet of wild turkeys? I've heard they eat acorns, but what else? Is their diet like the domesticated chickens, grains, bugs, worms, grasses, leaves? And then also about turkeys, we have a few domesticated royal palm breed, and when the jakes gobble or yelp, their wattle turns red as if flushed with blood. Is this noticeable in the wild turkeys?
Okay, well, first of all, for diet, adult turkeys will eat just about anything they can find, including things like small snakes, amphibians, whatever. In fact, there's some concern that given the huge numbers of turkeys we've got now, they may be having some impact on snake populations. But in any event, their typical diet, fruits and nuts, seeds, grains,
yeah,
everything from waste corn in a field. Acorns are a big deal. Any other nut crop in the forest, they have a huge, powerful gizzard for busting up just about anything that gets in there. So any type of nut crop, any type of wild fruit or berry. When the birds are young, the poults concentrate heavily on insects because of the higher protein level as they're growing rapidly. But as they get older, it turns mostly to nuts, fruits, seeds, berries, things like that. But they do supplement it with an occasional small snake, frog, salamander, whatever. Okay, as far as the color change, the head coloration on an adult gobbler, as you know, hunting changes a great deal very, very quickly with its mood. Much like the Jake gobbling that he mentioned. So if you're calling turkeys in the spring for hunting purposes or just photography or whatnot, that bright red head when the bird's really excited and gobbling, I mean, you can see that for a long ways off.
Yeah.
And you see that little bit of red, so holy cow, here he comes. However, once the turkey says, uh-oh, and either says, wow, there's Larry hiding under a tree and his intentions are not honorable, boy, that head color can drain to whitish blue very quickly as the bird gets the heck out of there. So, yes, the coloration of the head and wattles and so forth changes with the turkey's level of excitement.
Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, and we'll turn to Dick in Cross Plains next for a question or comment. Hi, Dick.
Hi. Thanks for letting me get on. First, a side thing. There was a conversation about badgers early along. A couple of weeks ago on the National Geographic's YouTube channel, they had a little competition about what is the most fearless mammal in the world. And they picked out the honey badger in southern Africa,
mm-hmm,
and showed it tangling with a lion or a leopard, mm-hmm, crawling up a tree and knocking a Cape Cobra out of the tree and going down and eating it and all sorts of stuff. It was really some predator.
Yeah.
Well, badgers are pretty feisty. And yeah, if you get to hold, I've mentioned this in the program before, we had a tame one in my class a number of years ago. But, you know, the kids get to hold this adult badger. I mean, the claws on those buggers are,
yeah,
the claws are 2 inches long. They can dig like crazy. And they've got, they're a member of the weasel family. They've got quite a mouthful of impressive teeth, too. So they're not an animal to mess around with.
Right. I live between Middleton and Cross Plains, and there are several horse properties, including my own here in the area. And this summer, compared to many past years, we've had an infestation of some kind of ground-living rodent. We're used to seeing the 13-line ground squirrels, those cute little things,
mm-hmm,
that have holes in the ground that are maybe 2 inches in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
We see this new animal walking across the road in broad daylight. A bunch of them standing along the sides of the roads watching us drive by, and they're putting holes in our horse pastures that are anywhere from 4 to 8 or 9 inches in diameter with mounds of dirt around them that are built up, you know, several inches, whereas the ground squirrels leave next to nothing next to their holes, and these holes are big enough to break a horse's leg.
Yeah.
Which is, and we haven't had these things around here in the past. It's just this year, and I'm curious if you have any reports of, are they gophers or groundhogs or woodchucks or?
Well, you need to describe the animal. I mean, there are a lot of possibilities, but there are a couple of really weird ones that a number of people
yeah,
would be interested in. We've had reports, for example, of a couple populations of prairie dogs that have been established from escapes or releases that would be most unusual and of great interest. There's a fairly rare ground squirrel or a couple of other ground squirrels besides 13-liners. The Franklin's ground squirrel is a rare animal that a lot of people are interested in. It looks kind of like a gray squirrel, but with a mangy-looking sorry tail compared to a gray squirrel, but that's about the size. And then not too far from you, if you cross the bridge on 14 and head into Spring Green, then you're in the range of the pocket gopher, which does a lot of big mounding. But the historical precedence is that the Wisconsin River has been a bit of a barrier for pocket gophers, and I'm not aware of any populations on this side of the river until maybe now. And the other possibility are, of course, woodchucks. It's been a good year for both woodchucks and ground squirrels, but a woodchuck is a pretty good-sized animal. So
yeah.
Describe, I know what you've said about the hole. The 13-liner has a small hole, as you depicted. The pocket gopher mound is a big area of dirt, but the mound itself tends to be fan-shaped or heart-shaped because the animal pushes the dirt out when it's digging with its hind feet, and it kind of spreads into this fan shape as they kick it out, and then right at the apex of the fan, there's a plugged hole. They rarely leave an open hole. So that's the pocket gopher situation. The woodchuck will dig a big burrow, and some of the openings will have a lot of dirt, and those are the ones that are generally, you know, 6-7 inches in diameter, and the hole is left open.
The holes I've seen didn't look particularly open. It was kind of hard to see them, and the area of dirt that was out, they were not absolutely circular by any means. I don't know if they were fan-shaped, but they were like 2 to 3 feet in diameter.
Can you get a picture?
If you could, you know, Dick, I guess I'm sort of curious about this, and you're not that far away. I'm going to be on the road a lot, but I guess at some point I'd like to get in touch with you. If we can't sort this out here on the radio, I'd like to talk to you a little more because there are some curious possibilities here. But you say you see these guys standing on the side of the road. What do they look like?
Oddly, the most recent one I saw probably stood, I've got a tape measure here, 15, 16 inches tall. It looked like a beaver, but it didn't have any teeth. I couldn't see the bottom feet or the tail area. Obviously, it wasn't a beaver. But the head, working into the neck and the upper body,
yeah,
looked like a beaver in terms of the length of the hair and the color of the hair.
Okay, and the color was kind of a grizzled brownish?
Yeah. The ones I've seen...
Well, that sounds like a woodchuck.
Yeah.
Running across the road, I would guess they were, 16, 20 inches long.
So these are five...
The tail
isn't
all that obvious.
These are 5 or 10 pound animals.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think...
Bigger in body than house cats by long
then
shot.
I think you've got a bit of a colony of woodchucks. Or groundhogs, if you prefer. All these other animals are considerably smaller than that, and woodchucks are out and about during the day, and you'd see them scurrying across the road. They have very short legs. They look kind of rotund and wobbly as they're running. They'd also stand up on the side of the road and have a look around, since they are essentially a big, fat ground squirrel, and their burrows are similar to what you described. So I'm fairly comfortable you've got some woodchucks around. And if you're concerned about them in the horse pasture, then you're going to have to find somebody who will come out there and either or trap or shoot them out to try and get them out of there.
Yeah.
Earlier about gassing one of these?
That's a possibility. You could try the gas cartridges, but the problem with woodchucks, unlike, say, a 13-line ground squirrel that has a very shallow burrow, a woodchuck tunnel system might be 30, 40 feet extending underground, and they have a number of openings, some of which are dug from beneath, so there's no dirt at all. So if you're going to be effective with the gas cartridges, you find the main burrow and then start working in concentric circles around it, meticulously making sure that any other holes you find are covered, and then go ahead and gas the main burrow, use the gas cartridge, and if the woodchuck happens to be there at the time, you may get them, but it's something of a hit or miss proposition.
Yep, there you go. All right, thanks.
Okay.
Thanks for calling.
I'm pretty sure that's woodchucks.
Yeah,
Larry.
Me too, given the size. Mike in Wisconsin Rapids, on to you. Hello, Mike.
Hi, thanks for having me on your show.
Sure.
I wanted to talk about bats. What I do for a living is I get them out of people's houses for them with any time animal control.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, we are experiencing, you know, the baby bats are learning how to fly. They're kind of like teenagers and doing stupid stuff and
right.
having accidents and ending up in people's houses.
Mm-hmm.
And I get 10 calls a day, you know, from all over Wisconsin with people having a bad evening with bats in their home. And I just wanted to go into, you know, what a guy can do.
Mm-hmm.
When they have one flying around in their house, you probably need a wildlife inspection, you know, as quick as possible, make sure you don't have a colony there.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, the dangers of having a colony in your attic, you know, or your walls,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, the histo, the possibility of rabies. What should a guy do, you know, if they wake up and their baby's room has a bat flying around in it? You know, that sort of thing.
Sure, we can talk about that for a minute, and that's pretty good segue into something else I wanted to mention anyway, Mike. For folks who get the Wisconsin Natural Resources magazine, the August issue has a great article in it about bats and many aspects of bats, including the threat posed by a disease called white nose syndrome that threatens bat populations across the eastern United States, to the new opportunities for citizen scientists to get involved in bat monitoring and survey work, and then some just general bat information. So that would be a good thing for folks to have a look at. But Mike's absolutely right. This is the time of year when no one's done any bat control work in June and July because of the nursery colonies and the birth of young. Now all of a sudden the young novice flyers turn up all over the place and cause all sorts of difficulties. But the issue is, the point is well taken. A bat in the house does not make for a trend. So it could just be an incidental bat that came in through an open door window or whatever. But anytime somebody's seen a bat, or especially multiple bats, as Mike suggests, it's a good idea to then start looking to the attic and wall voids to see if there's a colony in the house. And if that's the case, as desirable as bats are for their insect eating and watching them fly, and you might want to put up a bat house outside, probably shouldn't share your house with them because of the issues of parasites and potential diseases and a host of other things, not to mention the noise and the smell and the whatnot. So, bottom line, if you find a bat in the house this time of year, calm down. Don't grab a tennis racket or a fishing pole and start tearing through the house screaming, trying to swat it, because you'll do a whole lot more damage than the bat ever will. But simply watch the bat. Let it settle down. Sooner or later, it will alight on a drape or curtain or something. And at that point, while somebody's watching it, you get a trash can or cardboard box and just hold it under the bat, and with a piece of cardboard or a magazine, scoop it into the container and cover it with whatever you just used to scoop it with. Take it out and let it go. And that should be the end of it.
Yeah.
You can try the open door or window trick. However, sometimes you don't see them go out, so then there's some uncertainty. If you're not watching, did it go out or didn't it? And that causes some anxiety, coupled with the fact that if it was an incidental bat through an open door, you may gain one rather than lose one. So I don't think that's the greatest idea, but certainly letting them settle down and land, isolating them in a single room, and then helping them out either with gloved hands or a container is probably the smartest thing to do. But then be on the alert that this could be an indication there are bats in the house, and then you need to call somebody like Mike, and there are folks all around the state who do this kind of work, and get them out of the house.
Yep, there you go. Thanks, Mike, for calling. Appreciate it. Roger in Reedsburg, we're on to you now. Hi, Roger.
Hi. I'm just calling to say that I was lucky enough to spot a badger between Highland and Cobb along Highway 80 there. He was poking his head out of the cornfield looking like he was going to cross the road, and I had to blow my air horn to kind of redirect him back into the field.
I'll bet that did it.
I was very surprised. At first I thought it was a woodchuck, and then when it looked at me, I saw the markings on its head.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first time in my entire life that I've ever seen a badger in the wild like that.
Yeah.
And then for the lady who was having a problem with the woodchuck, I don't know if it'll completely chase it away, but what we used to do is we'd find the main den, and then we would kind of block it off or only give them one exit, and we would dump ammonia down one side, and that would basically, the smell of the ammonia would chase them out of their den.
Well, there are a number of cleaning products and other things that they don't like. Naphthalene or moth flakes is one, ammonia is another. However, it's pretty iffy whether that's enough to really drive them out. I've just been working with a woman via email who's got a woodchuck under a shed, and they've tried all manner of rocks and smells and everything else, and they've gone now to actually bringing in concrete and cementing each side of the shed, and they've now worked. They did one side, woodchuck moved 90 degrees around the side of the shed. Now they've concreted that side, woodchuck moved to the third side, and they were going to concrete that. So I said, well, I mean, it's inevitable here that you're going to have the whole thing reinforced, and eventually the woodchuck will have to leave. But sometimes it takes a lot. Sometimes you're lucky, and the slightest thing, woodchucks, I'm out of here. But sometimes you've really got to go to great lengths.
There you have it. Thanks, Roger. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today, and he's going to be with us right up until 12:30 to answer your questions. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist Larry Mueller here. Thank you for listening in. We will go to our phones. And Marion Danbury is up first, has been waiting a while. Mary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi, Scott and Larry. I'm hoping Scott can identify this bird or at least give me some possibilities. First of all, it's definitely a nocturnal bird.
Okay.
And we have a horizontal crank-out window,
mm-hmm.
and then way above it there are two floodlights. And almost every night when the window is open, there are bird droppings on the window in the morning. So I have tried and tried. I've gone out with a flashlight one night between 9 and 10:30. I went out at least 6 or 7 times. The bird was never there, yet the droppings increased as I went out. So it must come and go. You know, what possibilities are we looking at here?
So these are, you're sure the droppings appear after dark?
Yes.
And only with the window open, so, and there's enough of an overhang above it, so the bird clearly has to be up under there. It's not just a bird flying by.
I don't think it could
okay.
be because... Well, I suppose it is a possibility, but there is a crank-out window right next to it that is always open, but that doesn't have the light above it.
Okay, so it seems like something perching up there on
yes.
top of the light. Okay, but you've not seen it, and you've not heard it.
Correct.
So all we have is droppings on the window to go on.
Correct.
Now, what do the droppings look like?
Just the normal splash of white with some black in it.
Well, I mean the most likely possibility is perhaps some type of owl that's found that to be a convenient hunting perch or whatnot to take a break, and then you're getting some whitewash down there. There are, you know, I was thinking some other night birds, things like whippoorwills and so forth, are so vocal that you'd hear most of those.
And I haven't heard. We used to have one that every night, right after dark, it was on our garage. So we just so enjoyed hearing it every night.
Yeah, except after a while, they can drive you crazy if they're that close to your bedroom. But, you know, I'm thinking some kind of an owl that scoots in and out of there, but... there aren't a lot of other possibilities, although it's possible that there are birds that are not necessarily nocturnal birds that may simply choose that as a roosting spot.
Yeah.
Although I would think if that were the case, you'd have an opportunity to startle the bird with a flashlight and see what it is.
Yeah.
Now, so if you really want to find out the mm-hmm. the situation that we've talked about now with many of these kind of whodunits or who is it, is to either... And the best thing to do is probably borrow one. But an awful lot of folks now have motion-sensitive cameras, trail cameras as they're called, that they've got out on their property to see what kind of wildlife is lurking around. They've become very common. And they're also, you can buy an entry-level
yeah.
camera now for under $100. I mean, there are lots of them in outdoor catalogs or places like Cabela's.com or whatever. And you would simply have to mount this camera with the sensors pointed at your floodlight, and you, whatever it is that's coming in there, you're going to get some dandy pictures of it, and then we'll know once and for all what it is. So if you're curious enough to trigger that investment of time, that's the way to find out.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Speaking of birds, reminds me again of turkeys and permits, and got some permit.
You know, for folks who are, there are lots of hunters in Wisconsin, and there are various permit application deadlines that the DNR sets that are important in order to have hunting opportunity. And one that just passed, actually, was the August 2nd application deadline for fall turkey permits and some of the goose permits. And there were a few other permits in there, too.
Spring turkey permits, too.
No, not until December. So spring turkey permits, you're okay. I think that's December 10th, I think.
But you can apply now, I think.
Yeah, you can apply whenever you want. The deadline, if you miss the deadline in December. So you've got time to worry about spring permits, but the deadline has now passed for the fall permits. However, at least for some of the units, there were surplus permits last fall, as there were for spring permits. And I believe whatever surplus permits are available will go on sale at noon on Saturday the 28th online. So if you missed that deadline a couple days ago and want to hunt turkeys this fall, still got another shot at surplus permits if there are any. So watch the DNR website or check with your license vendors and make sure of that date and time. You'll have another opportunity, and then the next deadline coming up is in December. So you need to keep these things circled in red on the calendar so you don't miss out for a whole year on an opportunity you're interested in.
Rusty in Springstead. On to you now. Hi, Rusty.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
A couple questions I got for you today.
Okay.
This spring, I do a lot of canoeing, and the last few years I've seen quite a few Arctic loons in spring and fall. And amazingly enough, they are really tame. I do a lot of canoeing and on real wilderness-type lakes and conservancies. And these loons come within a foot of 2 feet of the canoe. They're very curious. Just wondering on if this is a little more prevalent in the last few years with them staying a little longer or what the deal is. And the second question is, when I was a kid, I used to see them. Pine snakes or whatever they're called, they're bull snakes, but I feed the critters quite a bit. I got tons, probably like 75, 80 chippies and red squirrels and you name it. And I spotted a couple good-sized ones. I haven't seen them in years and years. Mm-hmm. And I ended up catching one of them about 5 feet long. They're like a blackish, bluish-green color. And it was pretty hostile at first, but I actually got it fairly tame.
Mm-hmm.
And I released it. I didn't want to harm it, so I took it about 50 miles away and released it, put it in a box, and it actually got to be real tame, you know, within a couple of days, and I released it. I'm just wondering if that's what it is, or am I thinking of something else?
Well, one of our most common large snakes in the state that's pretty widely distributed is locally known as a pine snake, but it's actually a fox snake, pine snake, same thing. You can call it whatever you want, but it's a large snake. They certainly get up to 5 feet. They're generally blotched with brownish markings, but there's some variation in color, but what gives them away is their coppery-colored head, like a kind of a dull penny. No markings on the head, just this distinct coppery-colored head. And they do tend to be fairly aggressive when they're first encountered. They can kind of coil up a little bit and hiss and look threatening. But as with most of the snakes, if you can get past that and actually handle them a little bit, they settle down pretty quickly when they seem to figure out they're not going to be abused. But in any event, that could certainly be, for a snake that size, that could certainly be what you found. But it is that coppery-colored head that's the easiest identification clue. As far as the loons are concerned, you know, our local loons can become at our place, and interestingly yeah. enough, we're in Springstead as well as far as our cabin. The loons on our fairly small lake have been, while I was swimming the dogs a week or so ago, the loon seemed to think that was very entertaining, and he was within 15 or 20 feet of the end of the dock, kind of watching the dogs chase their dummies in the water, and the dogs didn't care about him, and he didn't seem to care about the dogs. So on an enclosed environment, if you're canoeing or whatnot, you can get pretty close to them, but I think these were probably our local common loons rather than Arctic loons. But nevertheless, you can get pretty close to them. So there you go.
I know musky fishing in the fall, we often will have them. I've taken many pictures of loons within 2-3 feet of the boat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dan in Duluth, Minnesota, on to you now. Hi, Dan.
Hello. Just thought I'd start out by saying I really look forward to this show and try to remember to make a point to tune in on the first Wednesday of the month.
Thank you.
I try and remember to show up too, Dan.
Well, hey, you could at this time of the year, you could do it a couple times a month. I'm sure you get plenty of calls and reaction. But I had a question about skunks. I live in the city of Duluth, and they're not at all uncommon. I've had a family living under my deck in past years and have tried to close off all possible entrances. And until the other night, I hadn't seen any skunks in my yard.
Mm-hmm.
At about 11 o'clock, I was outside and saw one come up from the alleyway up into my backyard. In the past, I've seen both big adults and small, young ones. This one appeared to be like maybe average-sized adult.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and grabbed a flashlight to see if I could see where it was going, because generally if you don't threaten them in any way, they're content to ignore you. Mm-hmm. And this one came out, and it was moving completely normally, but it appeared to be injured on the head. It's almost as if it had been scalped.
Mm-hmm.
The top of its head appeared to not have hair on it, and, you know, I couldn't tell if it looked bloody or not in the flashlight, and he just stood there for a few seconds and turned around and went the other way. But I have a cat that I let out at night sometimes, and I'm just, generally, he knows to stay away from skunks. I've seen them follow him around, but not, you know,
yeah, not too close.
Not threaten them at all. But I'm wondering if you have any idea of what, do you think it just got injured and was okay? It seemed, as I said,
not rabid. In other words, you're worried about that, maybe. Yeah, what do you think, Scott?
I'm not sure what to think. Animals certainly do fall victim to all sorts of accidents, same kinds of things that people and pets have to watch out for. So, I mean, it could have been clipped by a car. Horned owls prey on skunks, and I could imagine a horned owl with those razor-sharp talons swooping down and trying to snag a skunk by the head, and all of a sudden all it ends up with is a piece of hide, and boom, bald skunk. There all sorts of possibilities. But if the animal was moving reasonably fluidly, you know, it wasn't wobbly or falling over or anything like that, chances are that's an injury, whatever caused it, an injury it would recover from. That kind of thing is not a symptom of rabies or some other problems that people might be more concerned about. And in terms of doing something about skunks in your neighborhood or area, tough thing to do. I mean, these are an animal that are widely distributed, and if you've done what you can to make sure your decks are skirted so that they're animal-proof, that there's no pet food out lying around, you clean up your garden produce a little bit, and generally not have all sorts of hiding places and whatnot for these animals, they'll take up residency elsewhere. And just seeing one pass through the yard, as long as you and your pets have learned how to avoid them, is not the end of the world. So it sounds like Dan's got a handle on the situation, mm-hmm. but what befell that individual skunk, I don't know.
Thanks, Dan. Vicki in St. Croix Falls, we're on to you now. Hi, Vicki.
Hi. I have an identification question that I'd like to hear what you have to say about it.
Yeah.
On July 7th, three of us were driving a truck and horse trailer across the state of Wisconsin on U.S. Highway 8. We were west of Rhinelander in a wooded area. Mm-hmm. And right in front of the truck, and all three of us saw it, a large cat loped across the highway. It was bigger than a bobcat. It had a damaged tail, but much longer than a bobcat's tail. But, you know, it looked like a cat tail that got caught in the car door and got ripped off.
Okay.
And it was a very mottled color. It was, you could see a spotted pattern, but it was covered in like a black color. So it almost had a black look to it from a distance, but as it crossed in front of us in the bright sunlight, we could see this mottled color pattern in the coat. All three of us saw it. Of course, it went very quickly across the road and into the woods, and that was the end of it. But we were within not many yards of running into it if we had been going a little faster. Any idea?
Well, there aren't many native cats to choose from here. So if I was getting ready to say, ooh, a large cat in a longer tail, and I was expecting to say it was kind of sandy brown and uniform in color, and it was as big as a deer, and all of a sudden it said, well, another cougar sighting. But when you started with the mottled color and the spotting and the darker coloration and so forth, can you run the size past me again? I mean, are we talking something the size of a small deer or something the size of, say, I don't know, three or four times the size of a house cat, or what would you think?
Well, it was, I would say, somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 pounds, probably, maybe larger. I mean, we have a dog that's 70 pounds. I would say it was close to that size, though much longer than a dog. I mean, it was a big cat.
Well, I don't know what to say. I mean, that's really on the extreme side of things for a bobcat. Lynx are a little bit bigger, but unbelievably rare in Wisconsin, especially this time of year. So,
and it certainly didn't have the bright color pattern of a. We have a bobcat hanging on our wall, and it was an extremely large bobcat. It was over 20 pounds,
mm-hmm.
but it was much bigger than that, and it certainly didn't have that coloration. I mean, the
okay.
spots
so,
were not clear like that.
So you know what a bobcat tail looks like,
yeah,
and this
it's
tail
pretty short.
Was definitely longer than a
yeah.
bobcat tail. Well, well, so we're back to the cougar situation
with a bobcat,
again.
Bobcat, you know, that up higher in the butt. No.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I'm just speculating here that an animal moving that way and that size and whatnot with some type of coloration other than uniform brown.
A release?
You know, there's always the possibility of some weird release, but a young cougar does have more of a pattern to it, but we have no evidence that cougars, no hard evidence that I'm aware of, that there's been any cougar reproduction in the state, but we're certainly looking for it. I would, I guess I'd ask you, Victoria, to go online and look at some images of cougars, particularly young ones. I mean, you can go to Google Images and hit, cougar kitten or young cougar or whatever, and look at a whole bunch of images and see if there's anything that rings the bell. And then with your friends who were in the vehicle and saw it as well, you know, print one or two of the pictures and do kind of a lineup thing as if you were trying to identify a burglar you saw and see if they identify the same picture. And if that's what it comes out to be, then, contact through Larry's Facebook or whatever. Let me know what your friends and you decide, because that would be something that we would want to report to the folks who keep records on this. And the Rhinelander area is one of the areas where there have been a plethora of sightings of cougars over the years. And who knows? You may have seen something really neat.
Yeah.
So look at some photos. They're not hard to come by, and see if there's, you know what a bobcat looks like, and you're fairly mm-hmm. you seem fairly comfortable that that's not what it was. It's a really long shot. Lynx is a really, really long shot. It would have looked just like a larger, more ungainly bobcat, still with a short tail. So if it's got a longer tail than that, then cougar or mountain lion is a bet, and it's possible that at some young life stage that the coloration would match up to what you saw. So look at some pictures and see what you think, and let us know.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. As long as we're talking about online things, Kathleen emailed us and referring back to Peg, who was with the mama bear and the baby bear. Peg ought to get to know the folks at the North American Bear Center in Ely, Minnesota. If she's on Facebook, she can friend Lily the black bear and follow the progress of Mama Lily and her cub Hope. You can go to bear.org or bearstudy.org to find out more about black bears. You really do want to be careful. I hope Peg is careful around mm-hmm. those bears.
Well, there's been a lot of bear awareness and sensitivity over the past week or so since that bear attack out near Yellowstone. Of course, that was a grizzly, but it was a mother grizzly with cubs, and the principle remains the same, even though the two species of bears have very different behaviors. They're still big animals.
I'll put that information up on my Facebook page, and again, encourage you to join it, The Larry Mueller Show. That's the place to go to sign up for the Facebook page, and we'll put up some of this information on it today yet. Mark in Colfax, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi. We were camping up earlier in the summer up in the Shawmigan Drummond area, pretty close to the Pigeon Lake.
Know that area well.
Area. And we get our water from a artesian well. It's over in the fisheries area there. And when we were driving to the well, we spotted in the pine trees what looked like some nests. They were cone shape or upside-down pyramid shape, maybe 3 feet long, about 2.5 feet across the top. There was only one to a tree. Wondering if you have any idea what that might be. The nests were made of like small pine branches that were woven.
Twigs?
Yeah.
Eagles?
With the needles on them.
And these were down. These weren't in the crowns of the trees. These were
trees. They were just above my head, so they were like maybe 6 to 8 feet.
Oh.
Well, I mean, first of all, it's very unusual for any bird to be nesting that low to the ground where people or predators could get a hold of them. So I don't know. No possibility. I don't know. No. I'm going to give you a big I don't know, Mark. That one's got me baffled. So if there's a caller out there from the area who's seen these kinds of things and knows whether to attribute them to red squirrels or some bird or some natural phenomenon, then give us a call.
Okay, and then I also took a picture of my phone. I'll see if I can get it on a computer to look a little clearer and maybe send it to you.
Send it to us, and we'll have some folks take a look at it. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott, is antifreeze still poison to animals?
I mean, there are
some that are and some that aren't. Yeah.
There are, the ethylene glycol, I think, is the bad one. I think there are non-toxic alternatives, but I guess I'm wondering what the tone of that inquiry was. The reason being there are, in the past, there have been some ugly incidents with utilizing readily available products like fly bait, that went around for a while, antifreeze, as kind of home remedies to, say, poison raccoons or something in the yard or garden. And that is ill-advised, bad thing to do, poor idea, bad for the wildlife, bad for pets, maybe bad for kids. Don't do it.
Okay. There you have it. And with that, we have to conclude. Scott, thank you so much.
You're welcome. See you in September.
First Wednesday of September. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, will be back in September. We'll do it all over again. Connie Kilmark joins us tomorrow to talk about finance. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.